Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's occasional lecture. It's the last one for the year, and it's a bit of a surprise lecture, and we owe the fact that John Stanhope is here today to our friends at Civil Liberties Australia, who suggested that it would be a very good idea if we were to mark Human Rights Day with a lecture by John Stanhope. Now, Human Rights Day is on the 10th of December, and it commemorates the date on which the United Nations adopted the Universal Declaration on Human Rights back in 1948. So it's a very significant landmark. And there are many things planned to celebrate Human Rights Week around the country. And I believe on Saturday at the Arboretum, there'll be a rather special tree planted if you're interested. And I'm sure it's one of those many beautiful trees in the Arboretum that we'll be able to watch their growth over the years to come. Now, the Arboretum and human rights have a very special connection with John Stanhope because he can claim a lot of credit in both those fields. And the ACT, of course, was the first jurisdiction in Australia to adopt a Charter of Human Rights, and it's been in operation now for some time. So today we thought that it would be very useful and interesting to have John along to review the operation of the Charter of Rights in the ACT and related issues. And there's no one better qualified to do that. You'll all know John from his time as Chief Minister of the ACT. You may not know that he started working in this building quite a long time ago, and he was a committee secretary in the Department of the House of Representatives. So it's very good to see that committee secretaries go on to bigger and better things. But I'd like you to join me today in welcoming John Stanhope to give today's lecture.
Thank you, Rosemary. And thank you for the invitation to speak today. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I acknowledge to the Ngunnawal people, the traditional owners of the land on which we're gathered today. I extend to them my respects and acknowledge their continuing contribution to the life of Canberra. And it is a great privilege to talk today about human rights in our National Parliament building and in conjunction with International Human Rights Day. In so doing, I want to reinforce the critical importance a commitment to human rights has as the foundation of those core values that characterise our society. I'll look at the experience of the operation of the ACT's Human Rights Act, and I will suggest that there are three paths for us to take to improve human rights in Australia: bold policy ideas, strong political leadership, and more active community engagement. And when I talk about human rights, I mean equality and fairness for everyone, a society that commits to human rights, commits to ensuring that everyone is treated with dignity and respect. In Australia, the values that we regard as core to our national character, values such as freedom, respect, fairness, justice, democracy, and equality, each stem from a commitment to human rights. They're all the values that we enshrine in our vernacular as a fair go for all. And I believe strongly the protection of human rights is everyone's responsibility. A shared understanding and respect for human rights provides the foundation for peace, for harmony, security and freedom, and importantly, the right for the most vulnerable and marginalised members of our community to have their dignity respected and their basic needs fulfilled. I took in my decade as Chief Minister greatest satisfaction from the way that my government implemented social justice, freedom from discrimination, human rights, equality of opportunity and the rule of law. We introduced a Human Rights Act into ACT law in 2004, the first Bill of Rights in Australia. I believe it's led to better legislation being passed, more accountability to people in the community for the provision of services, and acts as a marker of our values. Its opponents, and indeed those that continue to oppose Bills of Rights, raise a stock set of objections to their enactment. But it is pertinent that the sky here in the ACT didn't and hasn't fallen in. And it's worth reflecting now that more than 6 years, it's now just on 6.5 years since the Human Rights Act came into effect, on its impact. My personal experience and observation, as well as formal surveys, confirm that the Human Rights Act has been successful in fostering the growth of a human rights culture in the ACT. cabinet room discussions in the ACT, cabinet submissions, ministerial briefings, and discussion between offices and within departments are all informed by the Human Rights Act. That's my experience, and it's the experience, I'm sure, of every minister in the ACT government, as well as that of ministerial staff and of departmental officers. The existence of the Human Rights Act is a constant presence in the day-to-day business of the ACT government, and that is its great success. The ACT Human Rights Commission undertook surveys throughout the ACT public service in 2009, which illustrate the range of ways in which the Act is used in or affects the work of the ACT public service. These range from issues affecting mental health clients, in teaching migrants, designing buildings, prosecution policy, juvenile justice, corrections policy, law reform, and the implementation of security and emergency management arrangements. It's also not unusual for questions of human rights to be raised in correspondence to members of the Assembly, in submissions to government, and I've noticed increasing reference in recent years to human rights in public consultation and in public forums. Additionally, the government is now far more likely to be taken to task by the opposition, representative organisations and the general public for allegedly ignoring human rights or the Human Rights Act. While the irony of the opposition, which trenchantly opposed the passage of the Act, taking the government to task over its implementation and observance, is not lost on me, it is, I think, a clear sign of its utility and efficacy that the opposition, which opposed the Act, now regularly uses the Act as a mechanism for holding the government to account on human rights issues, as, of course, it should. While, as you would be aware, every piece of legislation introduced by the ACT government must be accompanied by a human rights compatibility statement signed by the Attorney-General, it is to date, at least in areas of criminal law reform and corrections, where the Human Rights Act most starkly and consistently pervades the policy and legislative process in the ACT. The highest profile examples of the Act's impact on the ACT government's attitude to reform of the criminal law being the anti-terrorism legislation and proposals mooted for national laws for the control of outlaw motorcycle gangs, where the ACT took a markedly different attitude than other jurisdictions to these issues and where its position has been vindicated by the courts. The Human Rights and Discrimination Commissioner has also to date conducted three human rights audits under Section 41 of the Human Rights Act. The first involved the ACT Youth Detention Centre in 2005, the second related to ACT remand facilities in 2007, and most recently a human rights audit of Bimbury Youth Detention Centre was undertaken. The Health Services Commissioner has also conducted a services review of the psychiatric services unit at the Canberra Hospital under the auspices of the Act. The focus on using these powers has been to shine a light on the practices, policies and procedures of closed environments such as youth and adult detention centres and secure mental health facilities for which government has total responsibility. It's in these closed environments that people can be at their most vulnerable to human rights abuses and violations. The review function has been the most powerful in achieving systemic change at legislative as well as practical levels. Prior to the enactment of the Act, critics predicted that it would be a litigious feast for lawyers, a rogue's charter favouring the rights of criminals over victims, or would have no impact on court decisions at all. The same critics prophesied that the passage of the Human Rights Act would destroy democracy as we know it, with the transferal of lawmaking power from the Parliament to the courts. None of these criticisms have been realised in practice. There has been no avalanche of cases pursued by lawyers or of criminals escaping justice through human rights loopholes. There has been no instance of a judge or a court off on a lawmaking frolic of its own. In 2007, the then Director of Public Prosecutions, now a judge of the Supreme Court, confirmed that the practice of criminal law had not been revolutionised and that there have been no more acquittals or technical defeats for the prosecution than before the Act, nor an express reliance on the Act in ways that are different from the common law. Importantly, there is increasing evidence that the Act is being used as an advocacy tool for individuals in their dealings with the ACT government, similar to the documented use of the UK Human Rights Act and the Victorian Charter. There have been nearly 150 reported cases citing the Human Rights Act since it came into force. The great majority of these cases have been in the ACT Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal, with a small number in the Magistrates' Court, Children's Court and tribunals. Many of these matters involved issues of criminal procedure. The Human Rights Act has also been applied in a wide variety of civil proceedings, including public housing and private tenancy matters, discrimination, adoption, care and protection, personal injury and planning matters. In many cases, the Act has been used to support a conclusion which would quite likely have been reached on other grounds, but it has been decisive in a number of very significant cases. The enactment of the ACT Human Rights Act has had a demonstrably positive effect on awareness of human rights and their protection within the ACT. I'm proud not just of that, but I'm also pleased that the Act was subsequently copied and extended by Victoria, and I remain hopeful that in time the reverberations from the passage of that first Bill of Rights will continue across Australia. I'm also proud that in the ACT we removed discrimination against gays and lesbians, created Australia's first fully elected Indigenous body, designed the first human rights compliant prison in Australia, and introduced anti-terrorism laws that complied with human rights. The ACT also decriminalised abortion. As you know, attempts to ensure full functional equality for gay couples were thwarted when the ACT Civil Union Act was overturned by John Howard's federal Liberal government in 2006. And to my enduring regret, its reintroduction was opposed by the Rudd Labor government in 2008. But the territories now at least have more freedom to legislate as a result of the passage of Senator Bob Brown's bill, and as last weekend's National Labor Conference has revealed, my Labor colleagues, or at least a majority of them, have now caught up to where we in the ACT Labor Party were 10 years ago. The steps taken by the ACT government were bold and were a consequence of bold ideas, and their boldness continues. The ACT is now working under the leadership of Chief Minister Katie Gallagher and Attorney General Simon Corbell, and in partnership with the ANU on an inquiry into the potential and desirability of introducing economic, social and cultural rights into the ACT Human Rights Act. The final report of the Economic, Social and Cultural Rights Research Project, a linkage project between the ANU and the ACT Directorate of Justice and Community Safety, reflects the research of respected academic experts in human rights law, notably Professor Hilary Charlesworth and Andrew Burns, Ranuka Thillagaratnam and Dr. Catherine Young. These researchers reviewed the protection of economic, social and cultural rights across a range of comparative jurisdictions. Their report provides a detailed analysis of the nature and scope of such rights and possible mechanisms for their protection. The report makes a clear case that economic, social and cultural rights could be better protected through inclusion in the ACT Human Rights Act, and provides a draft bill prepared with the assistance of Parliamentary Counsel, which sets out a considered implementation model. The report recommends that the following rights be included in the ACT Act: the right to housing, the right to health, including food, water, social security and a healthy environment, the right to education, the right to work, including the right to enjoy just and favourable work conditions, and the right to form and join work-related organisations, and the right to take part in cultural life. The distinction between the rights contained in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights is an artificial one, influenced by historical political divisions when the treaties were drafted during the Cold War. Human rights are universal, inherent, inalienable and indivisible. Rights in the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights should not be seen as more important or more relevant than the rights in the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. Newer treaties, such as the Convention on the Rights of the Child and Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, do not distinguish between categories of rights, nor should the Human Rights Act, which is an important mechanism for domestic implementation of our international human rights obligations. Economic, social and cultural rights, including the right to housing, education, work and the right to the highest attainable standard of health, are critical for individuals to lead dignified lives. In practice, individuals and advocates who have invoked the Human Rights Act have often sought indirect redress for breaches of economic, social or cultural rights through arguments based on civil and political rights. This indicates a need for a broader protection of rights in the ACT and broad protection federally. For example, in the ACT case of Peters and ACT Housing, tenancy advocates relied on the right to equality to indirectly protect the right to housing, arguing that public housing tenants should be compensated to the same extent as private tenants where the property owner has failed to meet his obligations. As I earlier noted, in 2009, the ACT Human Rights Commission conducted a community survey. The following question was put as part of the survey. The ACT Human Rights Act 2004 currently covers civil and political rights. It does not include economic, social and cultural rights, such as the right to health, housing and education. Do you think that these rights should be included in the ACT Human Rights Act? And 82.6% of those who responded to the survey said yes. Similarly, the National Human Rights Consultation, chaired by Father Frank Brennan, involved the commissioning of research that found economic, social and cultural rights were most important to Australians, with the committee stating, "The research the committee commissioned demonstrated that economic, social and cultural rights are at the top of the list of rights that are considered most important in the Australian community. The way they're protected and promoted has a major impact on the lives of many Australians. The right to adequate housing, the right to the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health, and the right to education are particular priorities for the Australian community. The Human Rights Act, with only ICCPR protection, has not, as I said earlier, led to a significant increase in litigation, and the ACT courts and tribunals have adopted a cautious approach to their application. There is no reason to suggest the inclusion of economic, social and cultural rights would have more than a modest and appropriate impact in strengthening protections for these fundamental rights in the ACT. There is nothing to fear. The work of the research project provides a solid and practical foundation for the incorporation of economic, social and cultural rights into the Human Rights Act, and the ACT government now has an important opportunity to progress the vision and potential of the Act to protect all of the fundamental human rights of the people of the ACT. And I look forward to the government's response on this important issue. The passage of human rights legislation is of itself obviously not enough. It's also important to move the debate into actual policy initiatives and to test and act on creative ideas from other jurisdictions. The United Kingdom, for example, has a new piece of legislation on corporate manslaughter, which I believe has merit for consideration in the Australian context. A corporate manslaughter and corporate homicide bill was introduced to the House of Commons by then Home Secretary John Reid on 20 July 2006 to create new offences of corporate manslaughter in England and Wales and corporate homicide in Scotland. The bill received royal assent on the 26th of July 2007 and becoming the Corporate Manslaughter and Corporate Homicide Act. The Act came into force in 2008. The Act contains a duty of care that certain organisations owe to persons who are held in detention or custody. A company will be guilty of the new offence if the way in which its activities are managed or organised by its senior management amount to a gross breach of the duty of care it owes to its employees, the public or other individual, and those failings cause the person's death. Companies, and importantly government bodies, face prosecution if they're found to have caused a person's death due to their corporate health and safety failings. The Act was extended in September 2011 to cover all deaths in police custody suites, prison cells, mental health detention facilities, young offenders institutions and immigration suites. And it also, interestingly, covers the Ministry of Defence and its institutions. This is groundbreaking because the previous law linked a company's guilt to the gross negligence of an individual who is said to be the embodiment of the company. It had proved very difficult to prosecute companies and large organisations, and the only successful prosecutions have been against small companies where the director and company are essentially one and the same. The new Corporate Manslaughter and Corporate Homicide Act seeks to address this difficulty by focusing on the way in which a company's activities are managed or organised, and it's not reliant on one individual being found guilty of gross negligence manslaughter. The courts will now be able to consider the wider corporate picture, looking collectively at the actions, or more appropriately, the failings of the organisation or the company's senior management. There had likewise been no successful prosecutions of police or prison officers, individually or at senior management level, for institutional failings that have contributed to a death in custody. The background to the 2011 amendment was that in the United Kingdom, in the 10 years between 1999 and 2009, 333 people died in or following police custody, according to the Independent Police Complaints Commission. Ministry of Justice figures show that in 2010 alone, there were 58 self-inflicted deaths among prisoners in England and Wales. There were also deaths of people being transported to and from immigration detention centres, such as the prominent case of Jimmy Mubenga, who died while being restrained on a British Airways plane to Angola in 2010. Prosecutions can take place if it can be proved that the way the facilities are managed or organised caused a death and amounted to a breach of the duty of care. The penalty for organisations convicted is a fine with no maximum limit. Crown Prosecution Service guidelines say that the fines are likely to be in the millions of pounds. Campaigners for the families of those who die in custody believe the new law will provide extra protection for vulnerable individuals and at least inject some accountability into the system, according to reportage last year in The Guardian. Helen Shaw, the co-director of Inquest, the UK charity that works with families of those who die in custody, said, "While not all deaths in custody are a result of grossly negligent management failings that would lead to consideration of corporate manslaughter prosecution, many of Inquest's cases have revealed a catalogue of failings in the treatment and care of vulnerable people in custody and raised issues of negligence, management failings and failings in the duty of care. The new provisions provide a new avenue to address these problems and will hopefully have a deterrent effect preventing future deaths." Inquest said that until now, there has been no successful prosecution for death in custody in the United Kingdom, even in the 10 cases since 1990, when an inquest jury had returned an unlawful killing verdict. Implementation of the clause covering custody deaths was delayed in order to give police forces and prisons time to inspect their custody facilities and their management protocols and administrative arrangements to make sure that they were up to the highest standard. John Coppin, the Police Federation representative for custody sergeants, said, "This will mean the people at the top who actually control the buildings and the budgets have to think about their responsibilities. In future, if someone was to hang themselves from a ligature in a cell, not only would the custody sergeant be questioned, but the authorities could look at the way the building was designed, whether there were any obvious ligature points that had not been removed, and the force could be held responsible." As well as unlimited fines, courts can also impose an order requiring the company or organisation to publicise the fact that it has been convicted of the offence and to give details. Why would this bill be relevant to Australia? I'd argue just three reasons today. First, we have an ongoing problem with deaths in custody, and in particular with Aboriginal deaths in custody. You will all remember the terrible case of Indigenous elder Mr Ward dying in 50 degree heat in January 2008 while being transported in the back of a van in Western Australia. April 2011 marked the 20th anniversary of the Royal Commission report into Aboriginal deaths in custody. It recommended governments immediately work to reduce the number of Aboriginal people in prison. Yes, fewer Aboriginal people are dying in lockups and prisons, but more are in jail. And the situation for the next generation is dire. In the ACT's, our own juvenile detention centre, more than half the children are Indigenous. The Northern Territory Criminal Lawyers Association President John Lawrence says the lessons of the report have not been heeded. He said, "The bottom line is that we've gotten nowhere, slowly, backwards, up a hill blindfolded." Of topical interest to residents of the ACT is the current debate about the right of drug-injecting prisoners in the Alexander McConachie Centre to access clean needles and the consequences and responsibility that would flow if, as a result of their non-availability or non-provision, a prisoner is, say, infected with a life-threatening disease and subsequently dies. The position put and maintained by the CPSU, my old union, the union representative of prison officers, is that clean needles will only be made available to prisoners over their dead bodies. It's not clear who the CPSU believes should be responsible for the bodies of dead prisoners. Certainly not the union, and certainly not its members, it appears. Drug-injecting members of the CPSU, of course, and indeed all Australians, have access to over 3,000 publicly operating needle exchange facilities throughout Australia. Second, Australians die in mental health institutions. The Age, and I'm not a great researcher yet, I haven't quite mastered the Google, but The Age, for example, reported in September 2011 that 36 people in Victoria died unexpected, unnatural or violent deaths in Victorian mental health facilities between 2008 and 2010, according to coroner's court files. And third, there have been 27 deaths in immigration detention facilities in Australia since 2000, with five deaths in the last year. And there is a sense of growing concern about the mental health and treatment of detainees in privatised detention centres throughout Australia. These deaths are currently dealt with in coroner's courts in an ad hoc manner, state by state or territory, and mostly in a highly reactive way. Compensation has to be fought for, and structural reform to prevent further deaths is not guaranteed. It is moot, I think, to ask, if a person dies in the sorts of circumstances I outlined above, i.e. in circumstances where the detainee has not been availed of services or care of the sort or standard available to all other members of the community or which the community expects, and they die, and the death was reasonably foreseeable or a consequence of reckless or negligent failure to provide that service or an appropriate level of care, should someone, do we expect or believe that someone or some organisation or some entity should be held accountable for that death? The government of the United Kingdom has decided yes, and I agree with them. The ACT has now had in operation for a number of years an offence of industrial manslaughter, Section 46 of the Crimes Act. It provides that an employer or a senior officer of a company commits the offence of industrial manslaughter if a worker dies as a result of reckless or negligent conduct of that employer or senior officer that causes the death of the worker or serious harm that later causes the worker to die. There have been no prosecutions under the Act to date, but it is nevertheless credited with having generated massive cultural change on construction and industrial sites within the ACT and to have had a marked impact on worksite culture and safety. The legislation was passed following vigorous and cogent representation and argument by ACT-based unions, most notably the CFMEU and Unions ACT. And I'm certain that all unions operating in the ACT and affiliated with Unions ACT, which coincidentally includes the CPSU, and who were associated with the industrial manslaughter regime campaign would support it being extended, as I have proposed, to people other than workers who die as a result of similarly reckless or negligent behaviour, so as to cover a broader range of organisations and companies, including within the public sector, and of course, logically, the unions themselves. I think Australia needs this type of legislation. I think all governments in Australia today should consider it as a priority. I became a politician as a direct consequence of having been made redundant as a committee secretary within this place, indeed, after the 1996 federal election and the then cuts to the public service. Unemployed and living in a town dominated at the time by two Liberal governments and virtually unemployable as a consequence, in 1998 I stood for the Legislative Assembly, a classic case of if you can't beat them, join them. While the ALP was defeated, I was elected as an MLA for Ginninderra and was appointed leader of the opposition. I won the next election and have just retired after nearly 10 years. I have to say I always enjoyed attending meetings of the Council of Australian Governments, COAG, particularly while John Howard was Prime Minister, having regard to the primary role he played in my rather accidental entree into politics and indeed my very presence at the COAG table. It's been an enormous privilege to have been Chief Minister. It is a great job. The rewards are immense. The ability to control a legislative program, to develop and implement reform, to lead conversations, to direct change, and to deliver services people rely on. It is also a hard job. It's stressful and tiring. The hours are long, the workload's heavy, and it is at times puerile. And the constant negativity and the personal attacks, which are so much a feature of our version of Westminster, can be debilitating. The profession of politics attracts those with passion, yet surprisingly one of the hardest things about being a politician is to remain true. True to yourself or to your ideas, to your values, to principles and to those of your party and your government. In politics there's almost always this pressure, a constant pressure to compromise, to rationalise, to remain silent, to do nothing, to pretend that it really isn't your concern, that somebody else will look after it, to look away and to go with the flow. And the pressure is more intense in circumstances of minority government, which of course is the default position in the ACT. Most politicians, when they succumb to the pressure, justify it as simply good politics or as being loyal to the party. We characterise it as being pragmatic. We insist that we're simply reflecting the views of our constituents. We justify the breach of basic principle on the grounds of some contrived greater good. We don't implement controversial policies that have stood in our party platforms for decades. And I note that I believe half the women of Australia still live in jurisdictions, despite more than a decade of Labor government, where abortion remains a crime, because we don't believe it a priority. We coin convenient little slogans like politics is the art of the possible to comfort ourselves. These are, of course, all excuses, and I can't pretend, and I'm not pretending for 1 minute, that I haven't been guilty of dragging them out myself. But they are excuses. Excuses designed to justify decisions or actions that at their heart can lack integrity and principles, and often integrity and principle, and often attempt to disguise a want of courage or leadership. For myself, and I don't want to appear arrogant or self-serving, but I did try hard to keep the faith. As Chief Minister and leader of the party in the ACT, I did believe it was my duty and my responsibility to reflect the values of my party, and I did think the people of the ACT had a right to expect me to stand up and defend things that I had led them to believe in asking them to vote for me that I stood for. And it wasn't always easy. Sticking to principle, particularly if you're going against the tide, can be a very lonely business. And while it was often difficult to argue positions in the face of virulent and at times ill-advised opposition, I'm proud that we did. Because while each of these issues is important alone and each had to be faced and acted upon, the fact that we advocated particular positions on them did drive an important conversation in Canberra about our identity. And I believe governments have an obligation to lead these conversations as much as they have responsibility to deliver services. And I do think that time, history and experience will, or already have, vindicated the position which the ACT government took on the range of issues that I mentioned earlier. And I instance again the ALP's new national position on gay marriage, a position adopted and advocated by the ACT government for the whole of the last decade. I earlier gave some examples of the sorts of rationale that politicians often advance for not supporting policies or positions on important issues, including of fundamental human rights. And I've explained why we politicians sometimes behave in the way we do. But of course, it's not only politicians that behave like this or explain or try to justify their behaviour in these ways. When I read the papers or listen to radio or observe the community conversation on so many issues that I think are important, I'm often disappointed or surprised at both the quality of the debate and the extent of community engagement. I'm surprised at how many of us are happy for someone else to speak for us and to act for us and to purport to represent our views and our opinions. I have a strong interest in the human rights of prisoners. One of the achievements in my term of government, of which I'm enormously proud, is the construction of the Alexander McConaghy Centre with the human rights philosophy that I had hoped would permeate the place. And I am now arguing strongly on the needle exchange issue. But the debate is so much more than about the needle exchange issue or the health needs of injecting drug prisoners. It really is about recognising the humanity of all prisoners and that they have rights as humans. I think we each seriously diminish ourselves in this community if by our silence we passively condone the breach of anyone's human rights, including of prisoners, irrespective of how heinous their crime. My point, and I'm concluding on this, is that, and I may be wrong about this, and if I am, I apologise, but I have followed the debate closely, and I believe that there are, I think, maybe 7 Canberrans, 3 of them in the audience here today, who I know have engaged in the public debate on this issue, who have been prepared to publicly support the right of Canberra's prisoners to have the same standard of health care as the rest of we Canberrans. And I ask, why is that? Why are there 7 of us in a population of 360,000 who have engaged in what I believe is an incredibly important debate about human rights, the most marginalised group of people that we probably have in this community are the residents, the inmates, the prisoners at the Alexander McConaghy Centre. The only group of humans that I believe we as a community collectively are permitting to continue to be dehumanised, that they're not really humans. That's why you can treat them in the way that we do. Politicians should, of course, be expected to lead these conversations, but if we citizens are to truly engage in our own community, we do need to join in. And lastly, if our aspiration is, as I believe we would all claim, for a fair and just society, then we all have a role to play in achieving it. We can't all leave it. You can't all leave it to Maria and Brian O'Connell and Bill Bush to write letters to the Canberra Times about the needle exchange. We can't all leave it to someone else, and we shouldn't reach for an easy excuse. Happy Human Rights Day on Saturday. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, John. You've given us a passionate reason to support Human Rights Day and Human Rights Week and all that it entails. We do have a little bit of time for questions, and if anyone would like to ask a question, I ask you to go to the microphone on either side of the auditorium. But I might just start with a question come comment. The third last bill that the Senate passed before the Parliament rose this year was a pair of bills that had been on the agenda for quite a while. And it was a response to the Brennan report on how to implement human rights regimes at the Commonwealth level. And the bills establish a new joint statutory parliamentary committee as a watchdog over human rights. And its task will be to examine all bills that are introduced, and also it will have the capacity to examine existing acts and to assess their compliance with a set of listed human rights conventions and treaties. Since 1981, we've had in the Senate a scrutiny of bills committee, which has also had a human rights core to its function. And I think that it's possible over the years that there has been an effect on the standards of drafting of Commonwealth legislation as a result of the work of the Scrutiny of Bills Committee to ensure that particular proper standards of decision-making, of review, of making decisions according to criteria, making decisions according to specified criteria, and a range of other issues that involve fundamental ways that we apply and draft the law in this country. So this is a long-winded way of coming to a question. Do you think that, given that there doesn't seem to be sufficient support for a legislated Charter of Human Rights at the Commonwealth level, do you think that such mechanisms as a parliamentary committee can over time have some effect at least?
Well, yes, I do. I think, for instance, the scrutiny of bills process has always been effective in my time in the public service and as a politician. And an enhanced scrutiny regime, as has been proposed, as a response to the decision not to proceed with a National Bill of Rights, is another step. But I haven't seen the proposal in detail. I'm not aware of exactly what the remit of the new committee is, but it certainly is a long way from a Bill of Rights for Australia or a National Human Rights Charter reflecting our international obligations. And I think whilst I commend any step and any additional step in meeting human rights, it's a long way from what I would think ideal. And the great deficiency, of course, is that it's very much a parliamentary process. It's not a process that engages the people in any way. It's not a process that sets out as a National Bill of Rights or a National Human Rights Charter would. The standard, I think an important part of a Bill of Rights is the public reflection of a community's expectations in relation to rights and our willingness to be, and the willingness of parliaments and governments and public service providers to be measured against that legislation. So it's a step, but it's a fairly small one, I think.
We have a question over here.
Mr. Stanhope, you mentioned Father Frank Brennan before. He's quoted in the media as saying today say that any law to allow same-sex marriage is likely to be challenged in the High Court of Australia. What do you think about that?
Well, if it's an expression of an opinion around the fact of a potential appeal, then I probably would agree that I wouldn't be surprised if somebody would seek to challenge it from somewhere across the range of Australia. But if it's a suggestion that it should be appealed and that it should be and that if the bill does pass, then at this stage we're eagerly awaiting to determine whether the Liberal Party will allow a conscience vote, and if they do, whether there are more progressives in the Liberal Party than there are conservatives in the Labor Party, to see who gets across the line. At this stage, I don't think it's a lay down as there at all, that even if the bill is introduced and proceeds, that it will pass. It will be a close-run thing, assuming a conscience vote on both sides. But I, of course, support I support the Labor Party's new position of support for gay marriage. I'm not across in detail the form that the bill will take or of the proposal, but I support it. And if Father Brennan doesn't, then I disagree with him on this particular issue. But I can perhaps understand the basis of any objection he may have if he does object.
We'll go over here again, and then we'll go over to this side.
Based explicitly on the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. In fact, there's a very handy schedule which maps each of the provisions in Part 3 of the Act to the relevant provisions in the ICCPR. There is, however, one very significant departure which I draw your attention to. Section 9 of the Act, which refers to the right to life, adds firstly a provision, subsection 2, that the section 9 is not to apply to, applies to a person from the time of birth. And secondly, and possibly consequently, it also omits the word inherent, which is a departure from the ICCPR, which refers to an inherent right to life. I appreciate you have strong views on the perceived right to abortion. I would ask you to concede, perhaps, that there are others who would see that there are other views which emanate from a concern for human rights. I'd also suggest that it's critical to allow an inadequate debate where there are perceived conflicts between different or differing rights. And I'd suggest, lastly, that it is anomalous for the ACT legislation to exclude the full reference to international documents on human rights in this manner and to mandate a particular view.
Thank you. Yes, I am aware of the departure or the deviation that you refer to in relation to the right to life, and the Legislative Assembly and indeed the government, the Labor Party, the government and the Assembly in passing the Human Rights Act was very aware, was conscious of the decision that was being taken. It was argued. The position that you've just put, of course, was put by those that opposed the bill. I think, I'll state quite openly, it was, I think, perhaps the most vexed provision within the Human Rights Act was the question around the need for a definition of life to take account of other legislation that had previously been passed in relation to the decriminalisation of abortion within the ACT. It was a difficult conversation, it was a difficult discussion, and the decision that was taken at the end, essentially for the furtherance to remove doubt in the context of this legislative support for the decriminalisation of abortion, that we not create a potential ambiguity in the Human Rights Act around an accepted understanding or definition under the law of life and when life, most particularly when the criminal law assumes life or deems life to have commenced. It's a difficult and hard debate. It's essentially a rerun of the debate on abortion, is what it is. And I think we took a pragmatic decision and position in the wording of the Human Rights Act that sought to avoid a continuing debate about the commencement of life and the right to abortion or the decriminalisation of abortion. I respect the range of views on the issue, and that was the nature of the decision that the government and the Legislative Assembly took in passing the human rights issue, and the change or the explanation or the removal of a potential for continuing litigation based on the different views that exist about life and its commencement.
Let's go over to this side now.
Thanks. My question deals with the human rights of ordinary people, and particularly community groups in the ACT who do events on public land, who must seek permission. And basically what these groups are doing is exercising their human rights by peacefully assembling. And if they are jogging or running groups, they are then, you know, moving throughout the ACT, which is another human right. And yet these groups must seek permission, presumably meaning that a public servant can have the right to refuse. And yet basically these groups are doing their human rights, and I think there's a certain inconsistency there between having to seek permission and doing these community activities. Perhaps John might like to comment.
Yeah. Well, I think in any discussion around human rights, you're perhaps proposing a human right to gather or to meet, and I would accept and defend the right of people to do that. But I think in terms of any discussion or conversation around human rights, the right is not necessarily absolute insofar as it's accepted and it's reasonable that that communities, through their government, have the right, proportionately, to regulate activity and the activities of citizens. And in the scenario you paint, you're concerned that people might want to gather and people might want to have a run, and the government perhaps seeks or requests or requires a form of approval. But I would have thought that was reasonable, and I would have thought it's a proportionate response to the need to control the way in which the society operates or the community operates. You know, we can't operate appropriately if we say, well, you can run up the middle of Northbourne Avenue at any time of the day that you wish in pursuance of some notion around your freedom to be in any place at any particular at time that's a public place. Other people would assert a right to be able to drive down Northbourne Avenue, etc., etc. So it's always important to maintain a sense of proportion and the reasonable operations of a society or a community, whilst recognising and defending human rights, but recognising we live and we work and we operate in a complex society that requires rules and regulations. And it doesn't mean there's no recognition of the human right. It just means that the perhaps in pursuit or the enjoyment of a particular human right is sometimes constrained by rules and regulations, and that's reasonable, as long as the constraint is reasonable and proportionate.
Okay. Over this side now.
I, for one, want to thank you, Mr. Stanhope, for crafting a hair shirt in terms of the Human Rights Act, though I'm not sure that the politicians to whom you have bequeathed government would necessarily be of that frame of mind. But may I get your reaction from some comments in 2008 by Navi Pillay, the High Commissioner, UN High Commissioner, on human rights. She said, "All too often, drug users suffer discrimination, are forced to accept treatment, marginalised, and often harmed by approaches that overemphasise criminalisation and punishment, while underemphasising harm reduction and respect for human rights."
I think it's a valid point, and it's I don't disagree with it, but it's also a very complex issue, the contest between regulation of what are currently illicit drugs or substances. I guess that's the heart of your question is, well, why do we maintain our stubborn criminalisation of a whole range of drugs that people are accessing and the implications of that? I'm aware of a growing shift in mood, from, you know, even from some senior and significant figures within our police forces in crime prevention and detection nationally and internationally in relation to how long do we persist with the criminal response to drugs before we begin to seriously consider the costs and the benefits of the current approach. I'm not prepared to say that I haven't dwelt on it deeply enough, and I perhaps haven't thought about it enough to say that I support the decriminalisation totally or wholly. As you know, we decriminalised to a small degree private use or personal use of marijuana. But we did wind back some of the definitions of prescriptions even in that as a result of later advice, most particularly from the Australian Federal Police, about some of the implications of marijuana use and some of the extent to which organised crime was preying on the decriminalisation provision or capacity here within the Territory for its own purposes. But that was a difficult debate for us whilst we've maintained some right for personal use. In other words, there's a degree of decriminalisation of marijuana use and possession in the Territory. I think it's a debate we need to have. I'll state my position in concluding this. I think it's an important debate, a debate we need to have, and I'm more in favour of looking for ways to move away from the old zero tolerance, tough crime approach to drugs. Than not. So my view is that we need to move, but I'm not quite sure how far.
We've got time just for some short questions. Go over here first.
I just have a quick question, Mr. Stanhope. You urged private citizens to become more active and more involved in human rights. For someone like myself who's passionate about these issues but might not know where to start or know how to get involved, what would you suggest from that point of view? And a second question, have you considered applying for Ms Gillard's job? Because I would support that.
Well, thank you for the compliment, but no. I've done my dash. Something I dwell on a bit, this notion of engagement. Something I've been thinking about a lot over the last year or so. I think there is an issue for us as a community. I am genuinely worried about the degree to which, and I don't want to pick too much on the CPSU. I like picking on them a bit, but I don't want to pick on them too much. But the CPSU is the largest union in the ACT. The CPSU is also affiliated to the ALP. So it's the largest union affiliated to Unions ACT. It's the largest union affiliated to the ALP in the ACT. All household surveys on attitudes to drugs and needle exchange reveal that well in excess of 70% of Canberrans support needle exchange. Well in excess of 70% of us support needle exchange. And the position, but the CPSU opposes them. It has a formal position of opposition, despite the fact that it is the largest union in this community and it's the largest union affiliated to the ALP. I would hazard a guess that in excess of 80% of the members of the ALP support the needle exchange. I'm assuming that we are essentially progressive, and I'm prepared to go to 80%. That 80% of members of the ACT branch of the Labor Party support access to clean needles. I wouldn't mind betting that 80% of the ACT's public servants, the workforce represented by the CPSU, support access to clean needles. In other words, the CPSU is happy for its members, wants its members to have access to clean needles if they're injecting drug users for the sake of their own health and for the sake of the community. In other words, they're speaking for 80% of us when they say, no, we're not going to have needles at the Alexander McConachie Centre. And I say, why do we Canberrans allow this major organisation, institution, the largest single grouping within the ALP, the largest single union associated with the unions ACT, has just decided, won't even countenance a trial. Will not even allow a trial of clean needles at the Alexander McConachie Centre. They're speaking for us. And I guess it's that, I use that as an example because it's current, it's relevant to a very, I think, significant human rights issue. And as I made the point about the trouble always with human rights is that what people most affected or impacted by the non-recognition of human rights are people most exposed and most at risk and most on the edge. And as I go through the list of people which we as a nation have happily discriminated against over the last century, we have over time arrived at a position where we can no longer, because of a change in culture and a change in education, a change in understanding, you can no longer in this country discriminate against the Chinese, as we did through the White Australia policy. You can I mean overtly. You cannot stand up and overtly discriminate against Indigenous people. You cannot stand up and overtly discriminate against the range of different migrant groups that have come to the nation, as we used to, whether it be the Italians or the Greeks or the Vietnamese. We're just getting to the point where it's becoming hard and harder for our leaders, those that would drive us into panic, to discriminate against Muslims or refugees, though we still do it. But there is one group, and I used to be a Minister for Corrections, and I've been to ministerial meetings of Ministers for Corrections, and I've read the newspapers. There is one group of Australians on which there continues to be open season, and it's prisoners. Because none of us like, we're frightened of them, we're panicked by them. They're dangerous people. I believe this, that the one group of Australians on whom there is open season, whom no one defends, except in the ACT, I think, seven people, and it's prisoners. And I think it's just so unacceptable that we're down to the last group of humans that we can publicly dehumanise without fear of censure. And I just think those of us that think about these things have to stick up for them, as nasty and as awful as many of them are. But they're our brothers and sisters, they're our children, and they're human beings. So as how you do, that's a bit of a... I feel strongly about it, but I do about all groups that are discriminated against. Because some people lead such hard lives. So many of us are privileged, but some people have awful lives. And they need good people to try and change things so that their lives may be a bit better. But to just think about prisoners with blunt needles injecting goodness only knows what. The needles are blunt because they're old and they're used, and they're used by everybody and they're shared. They're blunt. They can barely pierce their arms if they've got a spot within their arms left. You know, the damage that they're doing physically, the damage that they're doing in the context of... but just the awfulness of it. And yet some of the letters I read to the paper, so totally lacking in any notion of compassion or empathy or understanding of just how awful it must be for these people who are... They're all Canberrans. The only people... The people in the Alexander are Canberrans. It's us. I don't know how you... But we need to get involved. We need to get engaged. There's ways of doing it. You join civil... Family and friends... Civil Liberties Australia, you join an organisation, or you write letters, or you ring up Talkback, and you just continue to strongly put a position of compassion and empathy and understanding and respect for human rights. If we don't respect the rights of the worst of it, it's the old saying, I don't know where it's from, probably the Bible. But if you don't support and respect the worst of us,
which is what it's all about, really.
Okay, I know we've still got some questions waiting, but I'm afraid our time is up, and I don't know that we could end on a better note than that. So I want you to join with me in thanking John Stanhope for his lecture today. Let's all try and do better. And to our faithful audience, thank you for supporting us during the year, and hope to see you all back again next year. Thank you.